From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Even as Washington is focused on impeachment hearings, news from around the world rolls on, too. The UK's election this week will determine who leads the nation and how Brexit moves forward, if at all. The FBI is officially calling its inquiry into last week's shooting at a Florida Naval Training Center as a terrorism inquiry. That attack was carried out by a Saudi Air Force officer. Russia and Ukraine meet in Paris for peace talks today, and protests continue to roil both Iran and Iraq. We'll dive in with a panel of top reporters from around the world. And later this hour, almost 20 years of misinformation about the Afghanistan war. We'll talk about the massive investigation from the Washington Post on how the U.S. government hid the truth from the American people. But first, let's get to that international roundtable. And joining us from Washington is Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor for Vox. She's also co-host of the weekly international podcast, Worldly. Jennifer, it's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Berlin, Germany, is Matthew Karnichnig, chief Europe correspondent for Politico. Matthew, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And with us from London is Charlie Daggett, foreign correspondent for CBS News. Charlie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Meghna.
Okay, so let's all start with the fact that the FBI is now characterizing its inquiry into that shooting at the naval base as a terrorism inquiry now. Jennifer, what difference does that make in what we understand or what we might learn from what happened in Florida?
Well, a few things. Doing an official terrorism inquiry with the FBI obviously brings in a lot of federal resources. This one is going to obviously have an international component to it, given that the shooter we now know was a Saudi national, as you said. He was a second lieutenant in the Royal Saudi Air Force. He was a student naval flight officer there at the Pensacola base. It's kind of a pretty typical arrangement we have with lots of countries, not just Saudi Arabia, where we bring in, foreign nationals of other allied and partner governments to kind of train and learn in this kind of information sharing kind of process. And this is obviously going to have some pretty serious consequences potentially for the U.S.-Saudi relationship. And the fact that it's a terrorist investigation, obviously is going to put that on the next level up. You know, with Saudi Arabia, obviously we have a bit of a history there. Mm-hmm. With the U.S. and Saudi Arabia when it comes to terrorist attacks. And so this is going to have some very serious implications.
Mm. Well, Charlie, let me jump to you there in London. I mean, I think I'm seeing them saying right now that he was still maybe was a lone actor here. What more do we know about that?
Well, before we look at the strain on U.S.-Saudi relations, we have to first consider, you know, the victims and their families and express our condolences. But yes, what this will do to Saudi relations, a lot of it has to do with what President Trump said immediately. He said that, you know, an immediate aftermath from King Salman of Saudi Arabia saying that they're devastated, he tweeted, that the king will be involved in taking care of their families and loved ones. The big question now is how willing the Saudis are going to be in giving any sort of help in the investigation, the motives, whether this gunman was connected. It will bring up questions about the vetting process in Saudi Arabia. There are something like 850 Saudis who are in the United States for similar training programs. There's a very difficult geopolitical balance that President Trump has had to make with Saudi Arabia. He needs a friend in that neighborhood. Saudi Arabia, obviously, historically and traditionally, has been offsetting Iranian influence. I was in the UAE for probably a month over the summer, a couple of times where we saw the attacks on the tankers there, the attack on the Saudi oil facility. So this is a relationship that President Trump does not want to dismantle or even interrupt. Now, the big question is how forthcoming the Saudis will be. And as you mentioned, whether or not this young man was connected to a wider network or where he was, where he found his extremism.
Well, I just want to play a bit of tape here from over the weekend, from yesterday, in fact. This is Florida Representative Matt Gaetz responding to what happened in Pensacola. He was on ABC's This Week.
Of course, what happened in Pensacola has to inform on our ongoing relationship with Saudi Arabia. That is the message I directly delivered to the Saudi ambassador when she called to offer her condolences. There are Saudis that are currently with us that are being investigated, and I made the point as clearly as I possibly could that we want no interference from the kingdom.
So, Matthew, I understand that you had a chance to interview the Saudi foreign minister over the weekend.
Yes. In fact, it was something of a coincidence. This happened a couple of hours before the attack. But the issue of the relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States and the tensions over the Khashoggi murder in particular came up. And the foreign minister, Al Jubeir, has a very well-practiced and very articulate explanation for what they continue to describe as a rogue operation surrounding that. That said, there are obviously continued issues beyond the killings that we saw in Pensacola going back for some time. And I'm sure many listeners will remember that 15 of the 19 September 11th hijackers came from Saudi Arabia. And we have this killing now coming at a time when the United States is planning to send more troops into Saudi Arabia to help the country defend itself against Iran. And President Trump has said that the Saudis are going to pay for those troops. I asked Al Jubeir that over the weekend, and he confirmed that they would be willing to do so. But I think it's worth remembering that the presence of American troops in Saudi Arabia was the original inspiration, if you will, for Osama bin Laden, mm-hmm. who, you know, obviously was a Saudi himself.
Right. Well, there's a lot more to discuss on that story, but I think I'm gonna pause on that for a while because obviously we want to see what happens with the FBI investigation as well. So let's move on to the United Kingdom and the latest in Brexit there, because so much depends upon this week's UK election. So let's listen to what happened in the final debate before Election Day, which is going to be on Thursday. Here's current Prime Minister, Conservative Boris Johnson. He really clashed with Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn over how Johnson says Corbyn would handle Brexit.
What would happen next year is there'd be a period of negotiation about this mystery deal led by somebody in the Labour Party we can't yet identify, since Mr Corbyn doesn't believe in the deal himself. It would then be put to another referendum to the people of this country. Parliament, our country, would spend a whole year more, probably more, racked, locked in debate about Brexit, when what people want to do is move on.
That's current Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and here is how Jeremy Corbyn responded.
Mr. Johnson will spend at least 7 years negotiating with the USA on access to our public services, on the price of medicines in Britain, on the access to our National Health Service, and he knows he can't get a deal quickly with the USA because of the way in which the US political system works. And so what he will do is walk out of a relationship with the EU into a relationship with nobody.
That's Jeremy Corbyn saying that the current Prime Minister Boris Johnson would opt for the hardest of hard Brexit. So, Jennifer Williams, I mean, every hour we've done on Brexit, the first thing I say is, so what happens now? I mean, what are the implications here of this week's election in the UK?
Exactly. I think last time I was on the show, we were talking about Brexit.
Exactly.
That was like a year ago. So, you know, honestly, Boris Johnson's point about Jeremy Corbyn is not too far off. So Corbyn, the entire time, and Labour kind of more generally, has had a really muddled approach toward Brexit. They haven't really staked their kind of claim to be the anti-Brexiteers. Some of the smaller parties have kind of taken up the mantle of that. Whereas Labour has kind of played this middle ground where they've said, okay, you know, maybe we can hold a referendum, we can hold a second referendum to see, you can vote on this, but we're also going to maybe renegotiate a deal. So it's this kind of weird, squishy middle position, and they've kind of played that the whole time, which means that if you're a really strong pro-Brexit person, you're probably not going to go for them because they're not going to deliver the kind of Brexit you want, and definitely not in the time frame that you're hoping for. But at the same time, if you're definitely anti-Brexit and you want someone to say, you know, our position is no Brexit, no way, no how, you're also probably not going to be super supportive of Jeremy Corbyn's position. So he ends up in this very weird kind of gray space where he's just kind of muddling through. And you know, Corbyn himself is not a particularly popular politician. Labor is pretty popular, but the Conservatives still seem to have a lead, according to all the latest polls. It's a small lead, but it's still a significant lead. So I think what you're going to see is this absolutely is the Brexit election. You're going to see people voting on whether they want to get this done and they're tired of it. And I think Boris Johnson's point, to my chagrin, I actually agree with him on the point that British voters are exhausted and they're tired and they're just ready for it to be done. Because remember, this is just the first piece of it. The next part of Brexit is actually where they have to negotiate all the terms of the trade and the rules that are going to define the relationship with the EU. This is just the first piece of it, and it's taken this long.
Right. Well, in fact, Matthew, that is actually what Jeremy Corbyn was speaking about in that clip. And I'm having trouble keeping up with all the Brexit-related news over the past couple of weeks, I'll be honest, because, you know, to Jennifer's point about Jeremy Corbyn having this muddled line, but on the other hand, hasn't Boris Johnson basically been caught saying things that are demonstrably untrue about agreements that he himself would make or would like to make? I mean, I feel like Johnson is the imperfect conservative candidate as well.
Well, absolutely. And in fact, we kind of ended up in this position here where he ended up getting this deal, this preliminary Brexit deal with Europe several weeks ago because he essentially sold his Northern Irish partners down the river and did something that he had promised them in the country that he wouldn't do, which would be to allow a customs border down the Irish Sea. Right. So I think it's really very difficult to say where this is going to go now. And a lot of people in Europe, my sense, in the sort of political sphere, are hoping that Johnson will win with a substantial majority, because then there would at least be clarity on where this process is going to go. If Labour ends up, managing to get enough votes to force a hung parliament, as they call it, meaning that no party would have an absolute majority, then you would end up in some kind of coalition negotiations. And then it gets much, much messier, as Jennifer was saying, and you probably would see another referendum at some point, although that referendum would probably be after they tried to renegotiate the entire deal from the beginning. So it doesn't look like whatever happens this week in the election that this process is going to end anytime soon.
Well, Charlie, I'm going to get to you right on the other side of the break that we have to take. We are talking with the roundtable of foreign correspondents about news from around the globe. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/OnPoint. That's Indeed.com/OnPoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking with a roundtable of foreign correspondents about news from around the globe. Jennifer Williams joins us. She's in Washington. She's senior foreign editor for Vox and co-host of the weekly international podcast Worldly. Matthew Karnichnig joins us from Berlin. He's chief Europe correspondent for Politico Europe. And Charlie Daggett is with us from London. He's foreign correspondent for CBS News. And Charlie, since you are there in London, what is the feeling on the ground in the UK as they move forward to this election on Thursday?
Do you know, it's one of the only things that makes me grateful that I spend most of my time in war zones before these things. No, but listen, I think Jennifer said British voters are exhausted. This is something like the third time they voted in 4 years. They're now rounding the final turn. Everybody is promising that they can. Tenterhooks, it really doesn't quite go far enough. It's more like a catastrophic cliff edge. What will be decided on Thursday, and we'll get the results on Friday the 13th, is whether Boris Johnson essentially will get that clear majority to stop what they're calling the paralysis in Parliament. And that's why it's the big story is Brexit. Jeremy Corbyn hasn't had a clear plan. He's talking about perhaps a second referendum, which many people are supporting. Even people within the Conservative Party are supporting that. We had Tony Blair and former Labour leader Tony Blair and former Conservative leader John Major over the weekend, or last Friday, saying that voters should vote tactically for a second referendum. But if you are to go with Labour, this is a huge left swing. They're talking about nationalizing major utilities, a 32-hour work week, giving more shares to companies, retirement age at 66. So that, if you go Labour, it comes with a huge package with that. And as has already been explained, it's impossible for Labour to form a government without having some sort of coalition. What Boris Johnson needs more than anything is to have that clear majority in order to push through Brexit. And that is what will be determined on Thursday. We'll find the results on Friday, and then we just go into the next round of what next for Brexit.
Right. Jennifer, just one more follow-up question, because you very rightly said that this is just, the UK is still just at the beginning, right, of this long process in terms of what happens if Brexit is actually seen through here. I mean, it seems as if right now the choice once again for the people of the United Kingdom is sort of a muddled half plan, as you were talking about with Labour, or the possibility of an extremely hard Brexit, as Jeremy Corbyn accuses Boris Johnson of walking into a relationship with nobody. I mean, neither of those things sound like they're in the optimal best interests of the United Kingdom.
Right. And I think a lot of British voters are aware of that they're kind of left with these two rather terrible options. I mean, it depends on, you know, a lot of people still did support Brexit, you know, remember. And there are people still in the UK who said, I voted for Brexit and I want my Brexit. And they do support that. But there are a lot of people who just feel like they are in a car that is careening off that catastrophic cliff and that nobody's behind the wheel and that nobody can really stop it. And so I think that goes back to the fatigue thing. I think a lot of people are just disillusioned by the entire process. There's been so much political wrangling. I mean, we've been talking about Brexit for years now, and it wasn't even supposed to happen in the first place. They called this referendum thinking that it wouldn't go through, and it did. And so I think, you know, a lot of British voters that I've talked to are really just like throwing up their hands and going, you know what, whatever. I don't even care what the outcome is. Let it just be done.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's move on to North Korea now, because on Saturday, North Korea announced what they're calling, quote, a very important test of great significance of one of their missile sites. The country has also recently said that nuclear talks with the U.S. are off the table. So this is putting that once possibly rosy relationship between President Trump and the North Korean leader on very thin ice. And here's President Trump on Saturday addressing reporters' questions about North Korea.
I have a very good relationship with Kim Jong-un. I think we both want to keep it that way. He knows I have an election coming up. I don't think he wants to interfere with that, but we'll have to see. He's somebody that I've gotten along with very well for 3 years. And he's gotten along with me very well. So we'll see how it goes.
President Trump on Saturday. So, Matthew, let me turn to you on that. I mean, this seems to be the president is still very optimistic here. Should the rest of the country be about the current status of relations between Washington and North Korea?
Well, probably not. If you look at the history of U.S. relations with North Korea over the past several decades and how they've often used these tests to provoke the U.S. and as a kind of negotiating chip. And, you know, unfortunately, these talks, which until President Trump was elected, tended to be very much behind the scenes, haven't really led anywhere. But I think where we are now is exactly what a lot of the president's critics were worried would happen if he agreed to a meeting with Kim Jong-un before he had some real kind of, you know, tangible concessions from the North Korean side. And, you know, as you mentioned in the intro, Trump went very far to describe the relationship as beautiful and, you know, went to the demilitarized zone and shook his hand and went on walks with him and all of this type of thing. And it doesn't seem to have really gotten the United States very far. And I think the White House has to be very concerned, as Trump mentioned, for good reason, that he has an election coming up. And this is an issue that is sort of percolating in the background, and it could explode literally at any moment.
Right. Charlie, what do you think?
Well, I have to say, first of all, North Korea is outside my coverage area, so I'm not the greatest authority on it. But you know, as we have seen this come up time and time again, where we have seen North Korea's leadership essentially provoking the United States when it serves them. And they have this own their own imposed deadline toward the end of the year. And they've been ratcheting up tensions, you know, in firing these rockets. So essentially what he's doing is just going back to his playbook. And of course, the entire world should be worried because we have a nuclear capable despot who's continuing to threaten the United States and President Trump with it.
Yeah. Jennifer, as Matthew pointed out, the past history of talks between the United States, North Korea, even when we had China and South Korea involved in discussions, none of them have really led to outcomes that provided a permanent solution here. So is there any reason to think that things could go differently now? Somehow I'm doubtful.
Well, you know, what we're basically running up against is the limits of Trump's kind of brand of personal diplomacy. And it's Well, it's correct to say that in previous iterations and previous administrations, we have failed to come to agreements. But there were agreements that were actually made that were concrete, tangible agreements. Now, the North Koreans and Washington will go back and forth on who violated what first, who failed to deliver what. But there have been agreements made. And the problem that you're seeing here is that President Trump's kind of brand of having these big summits and having this personal one-on-one loving, as he's described it, relationship with Kim Jong-un, it's all great and well and good when you want to have those photo ops. But the nitty-gritty details of actually hammering out agreements, it's done at the lower levels. It's done by lower-level officials. And that's where this is really broken down. And essentially what we're in a situation right now is we're in a stalemate. So the U.S. wants North Korea to take very tangible steps, shutting down specific nuclear facilities, testing facilities, before they lift any sanctions. The exact flip side is what North Korea wants. They want sanctions to be lifted before they will take any tangible steps to close down any facilities. So we're at this complete stalemate. And at the lower levels, it's not moving. And there's no guarantee or even really any suggestion that a personal one-on-one meeting is going to jumpstart that process. So it looks like unless there is some magical breakthrough, we are heading back toward the days of insults, of Little Rocket Man, of them calling Trump a dotard, which is, by the way, one of the best words, and, you know, potentially even getting back to the days of fire and fury. And so, you know, we really need to hope that the lower level diplomacy does work, but I'm not super optimistic.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you made that point, Jennifer, because I think, as you said, the most important thing to understand is the beginning negotiating positions of the United States and North Korea are polar opposites of each other. And and I'm not hearing any reporting of those beginning negotiating positions up for negotiation themselves. So, I mean, the possibility of a nuclearized Korean peninsula is still in our future here. But we've got a couple of minutes left to go, and I want to touch on some other big stories here. So, Matthew, let me turn to you, because we've got peace talks between Russia and Ukraine happening in Paris here. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. This is a format, as they call it, that has been around for several years. As many of your listeners probably know, there's been a war in eastern Ukraine between this region called Donbass, which is trying to break away. It is supported by Russia, and the Ukrainians want to keep it, obviously, and they've already lost Crimea to Russia, and there's been this kind of standoff for the past several years. In 2016, they agreed to a kind of ceasefire, which has been violated almost every day since then, and these talks haven't really gone anywhere. They're managed by the Germans and the French, and the United States, interestingly, is not involved in these talks, and they're meeting today, Angela Merkel, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, together with Vladimir Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, and Vladimir Putin. And this is the first time that the countries have met in a very long time. And so there is a glimmer of hope that the they might be able to secure some kind of, probably not a deal, but at least make some negotiating progress on this front. It's very controversial in Ukraine because people do not want their young presidents to make any concessions to Putin. They're afraid of losing the territory altogether. And for the Russians, there's a lot at stake as well because Russia still has Western sanctions to deal with, which have really hit its economy quite hard. So we probably won't know until the late hours this evening what is going on there.
Well, Charlie, I know you've done a lot of reporting on Russia and Syria in particular here. So, you know, given that experience and that knowledge, how do you see Russia and Ukraine and these peace talks? What's the import of that regarding sort of Russia's overall aims globally?
Well, you know, I was in Donetsk when these Russian-backed separatists attacked. And what happened in that Donbass region is nothing short of criminal. This is a peaceful area. It was clearly Ukrainian territory. What I witnessed is they essentially tore up those two cities. You know, we have to keep in mind, this has been going on for years now, and 14,000 people have died. And the way it is now in that region, it's this sort of semi-autonomous region where you still have Russian-backed rebels. It's somewhat managed financially, fiscally backed by Russia, but there are Ukrainians there who are essentially trapped in their own country. It was a power play that we saw in Ukraine. I witnessed it for myself, as you mentioned, in Syria. Mm-hmm. I was just there a couple of weeks ago. You know, we saw the shutdown of the U.S. Air base in Kobani, the largest base that was the center of operations and the headquarters in the fight against ISIS with the Syrian Democratic Forces. As soon as they shut that down, Russia made this power play. They moved in there. The Americans took away everything that was useful aside from a runway and barracks. And you had Russian state television just broadcasting all of that. Wow. A little bit further up in Khmelnytskyi, we were driving down the street. It was the most surreal situation. We're driving past this Syrian Democratic Forces checkpoint. So we're still with these are the U.S.-backed Kurdish allies. As we were driving along, we passed a Russian convoy right behind them, the Turkish military, because they are now conducting joint patrols in that region of northeast Syria. So that wasn't too much of a surprise. Mm-hmm. What then came over the horizon were Russian attack helicopters. We had not seen that in that area before that. And just after that, literally 5 minutes later, a huge U.S. military convoy headed into Syria, all sharing that same road. As it turned out, the Russians announced that night that they had just set up a new helicopter base in Khmelnytskyi. So they are taking over these areas that the United States used to have a presence in, and they're doing it so publicly. I mean, wow. There was a 7-minute news video when they shot what was going on in Khmelnytskyi.
Wow. Jennifer, your thoughts on Russia here?
Yeah, so I was actually in Poland just about 2 weeks ago. And, you know, getting back to the idea of Russia and what they're doing more internationally, there are few places in the world that are watching Ukraine as closely as Poland. They are terrified that what happened in Ukraine could eventually happen to them, that the Russians could continue. You know, they see it as Russia and Vladimir Putin trying to basically rebuild this imperialist, you know, past of the Soviet Union, of having, you know, this empire. And so they are very closely watching. And if you talk to anyone on both sides of the government, on both sides of the political aisle, everyone in Poland is watching and is terrified. Now, you know, Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, came into office. You know, he was elected on basically a promise that he's going to try to end the war in Donbass. And so, you know, people do want this war to end. What they don't want is for concessions. They don't want to give up Crimea, even though it's been gone. Russia seized it a long time ago in 2014. But they don't want these concessions. They don't want to have to go back and just say, well, we're now missing parts of our country. And so there is a mandate for Zelensky to go into negotiating in good faith, and there's some sign that Putin is potentially willing to talk. And there are some lower-level goals that are on the table right now, things like agreeing to disband illegal militias, pulling out foreign fighters from Donetsk and Luhansk, and even agreeing to have these elections in those two areas under what's this kind of wonky term, the Steinmeier formula, but basically having elections and letting these areas be under a special status. So there are some deliverables, as we say in diplomacy speak, that could come out of this meeting that are, you know, obviously below the level of a full peace agreement, but that could actually put Russia and Ukraine on the steps toward potentially having a resolution down the line. So there is a potential for having some positive developments come out of this meeting, which I think is good.
Wow. Okay. Charlie, we've just got about 40 seconds to go really quick. I'm boxing you in here, but I just wanted to have you touch on Iran and Iraq with us for a second here. Do you think you could give me a headline here in 30 seconds?
Yeah, I can. You know, I think what we have to be concerned about are these reports that Iran may be putting missiles now into Iraq. And that comes at the same time where there have been a recent rocket attack against U.S. forces here. That's 9 attacks in the past 6 weeks. We have to remember how exposed the U.S. military is in that region with Iran breathing down their necks, especially throughout Iraq.
Well, Charlie Daggett, foreign correspondent for CBS News, speaking to us from London today. Thank you so much, Charlie.
Thank you.
And Matthew Karnichnig, joining us from Berlin. He's chief Europe correspondent for Politico Europe. Matthew, it's always great to have you. Thank you.
My pleasure.
And Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor for Vox and co-host of the weekly international podcast Worldly, speaking to us from Washington. Jennifer, you're a veritable encyclopedia of international and diplomatic news, so thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna.
When we come back, we'll talk to the Washington Post reporter who had the massive investigation out today on 18 years of the government misleading the public on the Afghanistan war. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
It's been one of initial success, followed by long years of floundering and ultimate failure. We're not going to repeat that mistake.
That's optimism about the war in Afghanistan from President George W. Bush back in 2002. He was saying that the U.S. in the Afghanistan war he launched in late 2001 wasn't going to repeat the same mistakes the West had made in Afghanistan in previous military encounters. But fast forward 11 years to 2013 in the Obama administration, and we get even more positive spin from then Army Lieutenant General Mark Milley during a press briefing in Kabul.
This army and this police force have been very, very effective in combat against the insurgents every single day. And I think that's an important story to be told across the board.
Well, those are just two examples of the public and political messaging given to the American people over 18 years of the Afghanistan war. But today, in a massive investigation from The Washington Post, more than 2,000 previously secret government documents reveal that much of that messaging was deliberately misleading about the actual state of the war. Take this from around the same time that Milley talked about, quote, very effective combat in 2013. Quote, every data point was altered to present the best picture possible. That's a quote unearthed by The Post. Bob Crowley, an Army colonel who served as a senior counterinsurgency advisor to the U.S. military commanders in Afghanistan in 2013 and 2014, said that. He went on to say, surveys, for instance, were totally unreliable, but reinforced everything that we were doing was right, and we became a self-licking ice cream cone. One source told The Post that the documents show, quote, the American people have been constantly lied to. Well, joining us now from Washington is Craig Whitlock, investigative reporter for The Washington Post. We have a link to his story. It's called The Afghanistan Papers. That link is at onpointradio.org. Craig, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, tell us, what are these 2,000 documents that The Post has obtained?
These are interviews with more than 400 people who were key players in the war, and they range from commanding generals and ambassadors and people in the White House all the way down to people who were aid workers or military officers who served in the field. So it really runs the gamut. And these were people who served in Afghanistan at any time between 2001 and as late as 2018. So it runs primarily during the administrations of Obama and Bush, but also a little bit of the Trump administration. So these are people who all served in the war in some fashion, military or civilian, and they're very blunt and forthright interviews that were conducted for a federal project by an obscure government agency known as the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction.
And what was the motivation for the interviews?
Well, that's a really good question. This project started up in 2014, so 5 years ago now. And it was a project called Lessons Learned, where the Inspector General had decided that no government agency had really taken a look at the war in Afghanistan to determine what mistakes were made. And they wanted to interview people to prevent the mistakes from happening again if there was ever another war or situation like it. Now, you have to remember, in 2014, the assumption was the war was coming to an end. President Obama had promised repeatedly that he was going to bring all U.S. troops home by the time he left office in January 2017. So when this project started, the thinking was, well, the war is coming to an end. Let's talk to all these people, gather their knowledge and wisdom to see what went wrong so it doesn't happen again. But then, of course, the war kept going. And at that point, the Inspector General has been publishing some reports, but they really kept 90% of these interviews under wraps, and it took us 3 years using the Freedom of Information Act and going to federal court to pry them loose from this agency.
So 428 interviews, 2,000 pages of previously unpublished documents. Tell us more about what some of these members of the government, of the military, have been saying about the truth of the Afghanistan war.
Well, some of them really jump out at you. There was another interview done with Lieutenant General Douglas Lute. He's an Army three-star general. He's retired now, but he served as the Afghan war czar in the White House for both Bush and Obama. So two administrations. He held this job for several years. And he's extremely blunt in this interview. He says, we didn't have the foggiest idea of what we were undertaking in Afghanistan. We fundamentally did not understand the country we were in. And at one point he said, 2,400 lives lost. You know, was this all in vain? So again, this is a three-star general in the White House working for two presidents overseeing the war, asking these very basic questions. And if he's throwing his hands up and saying the war was a disaster, I still can't believe he said it, but he did. And it's in black and white, and we've got it. We've got those documents, and we've highlighted those in our reports.
I mean, the quotes are just astounding, right? We have here Donald Rumsfeld. I'm trying to find the year here. 2002, April 17th, 2002. He says in a memo, we're never going to get the U.S. military out of Afghanistan unless we take care to see that there's something going on that will provide the stability that will be necessary for us to leave. Help, he writes.
Yeah, and this is a one-page memo, and you have to lay your eyes on it to believe it. As you quote correctly, at the very end, there's one word, help, with an exclamation point. And this is in 2000, you know, the early 2000s, he's saying this kind of thing. The Secretary of Defense, if he's saying help, we're never going to get the military out, you know, it's pretty bad. And ironically, back then, the war was going pretty well. You know, the Taliban had faded away. The United States had control of much of the country. But yet here's Rumsfeld saying, help, we're never going to get the United States military out of Afghanistan. And, you know, ironically, of course, it turned out he was right. And I think even he, Donald Rumsfeld, if you had told him back then that the U.S. military would still be in Afghanistan, still fighting the war in 2019, I think even he couldn't have believed it.
So the fact that these interviews, that the people interviewed were involved with Afghanistan for so long really sort of lays out a picture of the amount of confusion on the battlefield itself, right? I mean, there's an unidentified U.S. official in 2015 saying that by the time you were finished, you had so many priorities and aspirations, like not really knowing what the ultimate goal was, that it was like no strategy at all.
Well, and that was, again, one of the things that really leapt out at me from reading these documents is we kept hearing in public over the years, both from Bush and Obama, and from their generals and from their diplomats, they would talk about their war strategy. Bush would talk about trying to build up the Afghan government and President Hamid Karzai and going after Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. You know, we all remember years and years and years of talk about the war on terror, and Afghanistan was the central part of the war on terror. And then Obama took office and he talked about his war strategy, his counterinsurgency strategy, which was to build up the Afghan government to make it strong enough so that the United States military could leave. And yet you read these documents and these interviews, and time again, people who worked for both presidents said the strategies were mush. They didn't make sense. They were unfocused. They say things like, we didn't know who the enemy was. We didn't even know who we were fighting. And I know that sounds incredible, but you have to remember that in 2001, when the United States invaded Afghanistan, everybody knew why. It was as retaliation for the 9/11 attacks. And the United States military was over there to go after Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda. But you read these documents and people say by early 2002, al-Qaeda was gone. There were maybe a few al-Qaeda left in Afghanistan, but the rest of them had been killed, captured, or had left Afghanistan to go to places like Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia and Syria and places like that. So they said, who was the enemy at that point? Why were we fighting the Taliban? We just – Richard Boucher, who was this primary State Department spokesman under Bush and then in charge of all diplomacy in South Asia, he said the Taliban became the enemy because – they were shooting at us, so we started shooting back at them. I mean, he was being a little flip, but not by much. He was questioning, why were we in this war with the Taliban? The Taliban didn't attack us on 9/11. Yes, they sheltered al-Qaeda, but why have we been in a war with the Taliban for 18 years? And that's the kind of fundamental question, again, not coming from people on the outside. These are from the people on the inside asking these basic questions.
Over years. I mean, years. Because, Craig, I mean, there's this a more set of like shocking quotations here. Donald Rumsfeld again, September 2003. I have no visibility into who the bad guys are. We are woefully deficient in human intelligence. And then you find a quote from 2017, 14 years later, an unnamed former advisor to an Army Special Forces team said that, quote, they thought I was going to come to them with a map to show them where the good guys and bad guys live. It took several conversations for them to understand that I did not have that information in my hands. At first, they just kept asking, but who are the bad guys and where are they? I mean, Craig, is there in all of these documents, in all of these interviews, is there a conversation or feedback on this is the state of chaos on the ground in Afghanistan? What do we tell the American people?
Well, no, not what do we tell the American people. If anything, there were a few interviews, people who worked in the White House and elsewhere who said, we couldn't tell this to the American people. There was one senior National Security Council official, someone who worked in the White House on Afghanistan issues, who very bluntly said that they distorted the data, the metrics, the signs of progress, and they would present this to the cabinet secretaries and to the president to make it look as if the war was going well when they knew, in fact, it wasn't. So there was a real effort at the highest levels of the government under Obama, this official was talking about, mm-hmm. to make it seem that we were making progress, that things were going fine, that Obama's strategy was working, yet they knew it wasn't. So this is a pretty serious and grave statement from somebody. And in fact, we're still trying to figure out who this person is. The Washington Post still has a Freedom of Information lawsuit pending in federal court in Washington to force this agency, the Inspector General, to reveal all the names of the people who gave these interviews. We were able to figure out about 100 of the 400 names, but there's 300 of them. You know, we know what their positions were. We know that maybe they worked in the State Department or in the military or USAID, but we don't know their names. And we think it's very important for accountability purposes to find out exactly who all of these people are who are criticizing the war from within. And that decision is pending with a federal judge in Washington.
Right. And Craig, to your point, I think it's urgent that the American people know as much as they can because of the cost in dollars, in U.S. lives, not just in combat fatalities, but the tens of thousands of wounded, in Afghan lives as well. I mean, you, right near the top of the story, you have Douglas Lute, again, the 3-star Army general who served as the Afghan czar under George W. Bush and President Obama, saying, "We were devoid of a fundamental understanding of Afghanistan. We didn't know what we were doing. What are we trying to do here? We didn't have the foggiest notion of what we were undertaking." If the American people knew the magnitude of this dysfunction, 2,400 lives lost, who will say this was in vain?
Yeah, it's a pretty sobering statement. There was another interview done with a former Navy SEAL, Jeffrey Eggers, who worked in the White House, again, under Bush and Obama. Under Obama, he was a senior director for Afghanistan. And he says things like, you know, $1 trillion, which is what we've spent in Afghanistan. He said Osama bin Laden would be laughing in his watery grave if he knew how much we spent. And again, this is a guy in charge of Afghan war policy from the White House saying things like this.
So, Craig, obviously echoes of the Pentagon Papers are rife in this revelation that you're reporting here. I mean, this project is called Lessons Learned. It seems, I mean, what lessons did we learn that we didn't learn from what the Pentagon Papers had revealed about Vietnam?
Well, that's a good question. In my head, on this Lessons Learned, I keep thinking lessons unlearned,
yeah,
right?
You know,
that
exactly.
we haven't learned them and we're making the same mistakes. And you certainly see the parallels with Vietnam time and again, not only in the same kinds of mistakes, being caught in a war in a faraway Asian country that Americans really didn't understand the culture or language or people or why we were fighting there. I mean, just those parallels are pretty striking. Now, in terms of these Afghanistan papers and the Pentagon papers, there are some parallels. Both of them really show that the government misled the American people about how the war was going. The difference with these documents is these are all interviews, firsthand accounts from people involved in the war. They're raw, they're unedited, they're notes, they're transcripts, some audio recordings. So you hear people's voices come out. The Pentagon Papers was a secret study conducted by the Office of the Secretary of Defense. It was all based on internal government documents, CIA reports, diplomatic cables, but they didn't interview anyone. It was more of an academic study that the Pentagon kept secret. This, on the other hand, is all interviews with people involved in the war. So it's more human in a way. You hear from these people in their own voices about what went wrong.
So, Craig, what are current members of the Trump administration saying, if anything, because now it's in Afghanistan is in their laps?
Well, that's right. One interview we obtained, ironically enough, or maybe not ironically, is with Zalmay Khalilzad. And he is the current lead negotiator for the Trump administration with the Taliban. He's trying to cut a deal right now with the Taliban. Yet in these documents, he was interviewed back in December of 2016 because he had been the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. He's an Afghan-American. And even in his interview, much of which was redacted and classified after the fact by the State Department because they didn't want to release it to us, they said it might disrupt ongoing negotiations with the Taliban. We're contesting that. But even he was saying back in 2003, we had an opportunity to cut a deal with the Taliban and we blew it.
Well, Craig Whitlock is investigative reporter for The Washington Post. His big news story is called The Afghanistan Papers, A Secret History of the War. We have a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Craig, thank you so very much.
Thanks for your interest.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.